Texting between two different kinds of phones makes photos blurry, ugly, and security risky. Not just that, it also makes video calling, editing messages, or leaving a group nearly impossible. With WhatsApp, everyone can enjoy seamless messaging with the protection of end-to-end encryption. Streamline your messages across all devices on WhatsApp. Message privately with anyone you want. Click the banner or download now to learn more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1979, Brenda Spencer, a seemingly average teenage girl living in a nice suburban neighborhood, made and executed plans that would place her in infamy and set a violent and terrifying national precedent. She received a rifle for Christmas, and a month later set her sights and opened fire on the elementary school across the street. The event is forever glorified by the song "I Don't Like Mondays" by the Boomtown Rats, and marks the bloody beginning of the American phenomenon of school shootings. Long before Columbine and Sandy Hook, there was Brenda Spencer. I Don't Like Mondays, the true story of America's first modern school shooting, sifts through the mythology that has sprung up around this fateful day, presenting the raw and riveting facts for the first time. This book lays bare the seemingly average teenage girl's brutal motives and subsequent arrest. N. Lee Hunt spent years researching and uncovering shocking details from officers, investigators, and lost police dispatches. He has interviewed people who were on the scene and local reporters who spoke with them, with the perpetrator directly after her shooting spree. Hunt has even cultivated an unlikely rapport with the killer and, through personal interviews, has shed light on previously unknown details about her upbringing and influences. The book that we're featuring this evening is I Don't Like Mondays, the true story behind America's first modern school shooting, with my special guest, author, crime historian, and broadcaster, N. Lee Hunt. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, N. Lee Hunt.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Now, first off, please tell us how you came to be the author of this story, why you wanted to do this story, and how you had the opportunity.
Well, I grew up in San Diego, like so many people, and, you know San Diego as being that small town in the 70s, and it just grew bigger and bigger and bigger. Now it's a massive city. My parents were British, and we moved there, sort of living the American dream when I was a young kid. My dad was the journalist, the San Diego Evening Tribune at the time, and he was working at the city desk. And one day he came home from school and said, "You won't believe what's happened. I'm so glad you're safe." And he just said, "You know, a number of kids your age were just shot today at school, and it's just changed San Diego forever." And we sat for a long time and talked about the story. So it's something I was essentially my first venture into true crime, if you will. I mean, now it's a genre that everyone talks about. Back then, it was just called horror. And right. I spent my entire life thinking of this case. And it was something that's, you know, I went in to do research in crime history, and I studied serial killers for a long time. I went into broadcasting and even done some radio stuff about local crime. And someone said to me, you know, you really should write a book about Brenda Spencer because you know so much about it, because your father was heavily involved in what happened that day. And it wasn't till I sort of got late into my years that I noticed that no one had written a book about this. Nobody had ever sort of captured it. But yet we're hearing every single year, and sometimes more than once a year, about another school shooting that was happening in America, and nothing was changing. So I just dove deep into it and thought, let's actually recount all the facts. Let's get all the information without any hoopla, without any media hype, and just recount everything that happened that day by everyone who was involved. And maybe we could come to some sort of idea as to why it happened. I'm not looking for a solution. I just wanted to sort of get the facts together to see if maybe the story behind Brenda is not that different than the story behind all the other dozens of school shootings. So that's pretty much the motivation for doing it. I went back to my basics, the one that actually brought true crime into my orbit, and just thought, let's just make my first book about Brenda. And that's exactly what I did. So I wrote to her, she wrote back, and the rest is history.
Well, let's get to that history. As you write, Monday, January 29th, 1979, in San Carlos, which is a suburb of San Diego, a little after 8 a.m. Tell us what happens at this Cleveland school.
Yeah, we'll start with San Carlos, because San Carlos is actually more of like a really big neighborhood in sort of the east county of the San Diego city. And the reason why that's important is because I think people in the east county of San Diego felt that it was part of the county, which the sheriffs would be part of their jurisdiction. And the city kind of probably didn't even know that it existed. When people said San Carlos, well, I didn't know where it was, but it was actually the police, the local police, who were called to attend. So shots ring out. The receptionist at the school hears the bullets and looks around and doesn't know where they're coming from. Nobody can really identify where the bullets were coming from. Kids were running into the office saying they were being shot. Children had fallen in the driveway leading up to the front of the school. And this is a California-style sort of bungalow-style school. So it's one level. It's not like the tall school buildings that you see on the East Coast of America. This is a very small, one-level school with a car park in the front. Right. And the kids came running up, and the receptionist called to the police. And back then, you dialed zero and asked the operator, and then said, I need the police. So there was no 911. There were no paramedics. It was literally just scared people on the phone calling other people who were hoping to do the right thing to dispatch. Police started turning up as fast as they could from all over the city, and everybody came in. And as they arrived on the scene, it was then quickly determined that Brenda was across the road shooting from her front door with a .22. And she had already shot a number of students, and bullets had hit the principal and the custodian as they came out to rescue children in the front of the school. Quite an alarming scene.
You write that there were parents at this time and at various stages after 8 a.m. that were dropping off their kids that were oblivious to this sniper across the street shooting at students and teachers and staff.
Exactly right. A .22 caliber rifle is not the loudest of weapons. It's one of the smallest caliber weapons that was available at that time. Brenda was a 16-year-old girl who received it for Christmas just prior to the shooting, which was January 29th. So she only had it just over a month. And these bullets were ringing out. People thought, you know, perhaps it was backfiring car. Perhaps it was even fireworks because it was the Chinese New Year weekend just passed. Parents pulled up in their car, dropped their kids off. Kids got out of the car. They drove away. Like any normal school day, it was quite unremarkable in that respect. Except for Brenda was shooting from across the road. So one of the students that luckily got away actually was dropped off by their mother and just walked up the path happily while someone was shot right next to them. Could have been them. I'm very lucky to survive.
Tell us about the actions of Principal Ragg and also custodian Mike Sukar, which they called Mr. Mike.
Yeah, Mr. Mike was sort of this sort of legendary big hero guy. You know, one of these big sort of strapping veteran who took care of the school and everybody liked him. Principal Ragg was a career educator, really decent guy. A lot of students tell stories about how he would pretend to have the same interests as them to keep them motivated and interested in school each day. He really, really, these two guys seemed as if, you know, some of the greatest people that had ever worked within the educational environment in San Diego. They saw a child fall to the ground, didn't know what it was. I think without thinking, both these gentlemen ran to the front of the school to help the children. One of them saw the other fall to the ground with some sort of injury, didn't know what that was. So they ran to his rescue. So it was essentially just people, you know, who were in role model positions taking care of their students. And Brenda targeted them. I think they were larger targets for her. Perhaps maybe she was aiming for the adults because she didn't actually kill any children that day. And she swiftly landed bullets right into the chest of both these gentlemen. It was quite a shame. Police arrived and were told to arrive in the back of the school. Some did, some didn't. Because this is going back to the days of radio dispatch. They ran right to the scene. One of them, Officer Rob, ran straight up to Mr. Mike and Principal Ragg and took a bullet straight to his neck. With all the adrenaline, he was still managed to lift them to a gurney and get them into an ambulance and off to the hospital. And then later found that the bullet hit his spine and he then later collapsed. but did survive.
There was another officer that realized that there was a trash truck and he could use it to his advantage. What did they do with this trash truck?
Well, yeah, Ted Kasignak, who I've now sort of become friends with in a way, he's a bit of a hero. He arrived from the opposite side of the school and was able to sort of identify that, hey, this shooting is coming from across the road. And he sort of looked around and didn't know what to do. And a large trash truck had just been, you know, picking up the trash on any normal neighborhood. And I've got to sort of mention that San Carlos is sort of like a Spielberg-esque type neighborhood. This is a very typical tract home, you know, sort of all sort of single level dwellings.
Right.
All the houses down the road kind of look alike. All the gardens are maintained. This is a very nice neighborhood in Southern California standard. He saw the garbage truck and thought, you know what? These people are being shot in front of the school. And somehow he jumped in it and commandeered it, got it started, drove it up a narrow part, the parking lot in front of the school around a few vehicles that were parked there, and managed to pull it within 20 feet of the front entrance to the school, the walkway, blocking Brenda's vision from all the students that were hiding along that walkway. He saved potentially dozens of lives that day. It's one of the most heroic, I think, in San Diego history, probably one of the most heroic things that could have happened that day. And certainly school shootings 43 later could still use that type of heroic action. So Ted Kasignak is pretty much a legend. He stayed the entire day behind that truck, keeping safe on Brenda until finally she was apprehended. It's quite a remarkable feat.
You had one of the teachers is featured in this book named Barnes, and he was seeing the principal and the custodian down in front of the school and then was yelling to children that were oblivious to run and run into the school. Tell us about the efforts of the teachers to safeguard these students, not realizing what was going on whatsoever regarding the sniper across the street.
Yeah, I think when the principal and the custodian, it was traditional for the principal to be out in the mornings to open the gate with the custodian and even wave to parents. You know, they were doing their role, so they were in the place they needed to be. Barnes, the teacher, was sort of, his role was more to stay in the office and to take care of some of the administration stuff. So when he saw this unfolding, he had no choice but to take a leadership role. He was the assistant principal. It was, I suppose, he took that role. And he essentially ushered dozens and dozens of children and actually organized some of the other teachers to take the children into their rooms, lock the door, hide, get down. I think unwittingly, Barnes and the other teachers who were on scene that day, and some of the police officers, I think they were unwittingly setting up dynamic sort of crisis education for all the children. And a lot of the things that they did that day are incorporated in the ALICE training, which is the school violence training that police officers get today, just by their actions that day that saved lives. It was essentially duck and cover is what Barnes was telling the students. And they all ran for cover. Some were stuck in the bushes along the walkway. Some were behind the cars in the parking lot, in between sort of the front of the school and Brenda's house across the road. I think he just said, we're all getting for cover. Everybody get down. And he continued this chant throughout. The fire alarm was going off. There was a lot of stress. More parents were pulling up with children in their cars. It really became quite a scene. You can imagine, for those who were at the school, they could hear the gunshots and knew what was going on. But for those just arriving, all they could hear was fire alarm and a frenzied teacher telling everyone to get down. It's probably quite an alarming scene.
Now, the San Diego Evening Tribune comes into this story with police reporter Frank Saldera. He's on the police scanner. And he recognized the call was out of the ordinary. So he calls into the newspaper's head office. And the chief assistant city editor is Bernie Hunt, your father. Tell us about this.
That's right, my father, yeah. So his role was to make sure all the reporters were out on their beat doing their stuff. And Frank was down at the cop shop, as they call it. And, he, you know, a shooting in San Diego was not that uncommon. It was uncommon, but not that uncommon. But that time of the morning at a school, it was really uncommon. And they took the call. And immediately my dad sort of dispatched anybody who was around. But at 8 o'clock in the morning, the newspapers are already out in their day. They're, you know, they're the evening paper. They're already kind of started their day. It's their deadline. It's sort of around 9 a.m. So this was sort of right at a key moment where people weren't available. My dad and Mike Walker, who is the city editor, they walked down to a desk where they found an available reporter. And it just happened to be Steve Wiegand, who was the political reporter for San Diego. And he was just getting ready to leave up to Los Angeles to cover some politics that was going on around town. And he said, you're not going anywhere. I need you to start making phone calls. We got a shooter in San Carlos. And of course, everyone said, where? And he said, look, just cover it. Here's a crisscross directory. Now, way back in the day, you and I are probably old enough to remember, but many people won't be.
Right.
They used to have these big phone books with everybody's name in it and their phone numbers. And they have this thing called the crisscross, which was the exact opposite of that. So it had the address with the phone number and the name of people. So you can look it up by address. So Steve Wiegand just thumbed through this phone book, crisscross directory, found the house that was across the street from the shooting, from the school. He dialed it first. It was a very sort of easy number to dial. because I think that the dial was 2345 were the last four digits. So he went there first. A young girl answers the phone and he initially says, you know, is your mom home? Because he can't believe that, you know, what's she doing home? It's got to be a parent I want to speak with. And she said, no, I'm here alone. He said, well, I hear there's a shooting. Do you know anything about it? And she says, yeah, it's me. And he doesn't believe it. Wow. She kind of hangs up and he calls back away and says, well, why are you doing this? And she says, well, you know, I just don't like Mondays. It livens up the day. I got to go now and do some more shooting. So Steve Wiegand and the guys at the Evening Tribune, one of them being my father, had actually stopped Brenda in mid-shot to answer the telephone. Either her vanity or her adolescence, I don't know what it was, stopped her from shooting to answer the phone. It's quite remarkable.
He asked her obvious questions right away, like, why are you shooting at innocent people? What kind of responses does he get?
I don't think he gets any clear response other than I just don't like Mondays. This livens up the day. You know, I see their blue jumpers. I want to shoot them. You know, I don't think he was getting anything out of her. Immediately, he says to my dad, he says, you know, to the editors, he says, look, I've got her on the phone. And my dad says, well, you get to writing the story because we're hitting deadline. He calls in Gus, who's another key journalist and reporter who was on the scene, and said, you give her a call back. You get as much information out of her as you can. And the two of them sort of worked together to fashion a story for the front page that afternoon. It was all about getting the story and all about finding out why she was doing it. I don't think they got any clearer or anything really out of her, but is most remarkably that she stopped shooting people in order to tell everybody what she was up to. Eventually, if I can carry on with the story, they try and stay on the phone with her as long as they possibly can, because I think twofold, they realize that they're getting the story, which of course they're reporters and that's their job. Secondly, I think they suddenly realize that as long as they speak to her, she's not shooting anybody else. Eventually, the police have now cordoned off the area. The students are pretty much in safety. Ted Kazanak had done this in a tremendous job of blocking her vision with this truck. They eventually call the Tribune and go, we hear you're on the phone with the shooter. Knock it off. Get off the phone. We want to speak with her. And that's kind of where they kind of put it to rest there and just decided to go to press with the story.
Now, the police contact parents, Wally and Dorothy, which they call Dot. What do they find from the parents? What information do they find from the parents? And what do they want from the parents at that time?
Well, again, she's, you know, they know that she's underage, or they believe she's underage. They're going to contact the parents, certainly. The father was only working at San Diego State University, not far away, so he was quite available. And he was semi-popular at work, so people knew him. The mother was working at a golf tournament up in Torrey Pines. San Diego has this beautiful golf course. I don't even know Torrey Pines, but it's absolutely stunning. And she was one of the accountants for a huge golf tournament that just happened over that weekend. They initially call her and she says, you know, I can't make it. I've got a table full of cash. I'm counting money. I can't come, whatever it is. Brenda can handle it. And they said, no, I don't think you understand. Your daughter is shooting people. And I think there's something in that that has never sat right with me, with the fact that the mother didn't immediately jump to attention. The family had gone through a horrible divorce a number of years before. And I think Dot had just felt that Brenda was Wally's problem, or Wally should take care of all these little things like whatever Brenda's not going to school or whatever she's doing during her day. Wally came right to the scene, came right to the cordon where the police blocked the road, and actually started giving as much information as he could. He told the police officers that this is my daughter. This is where she goes to school. This is how old she is. This is the weapon she has. This is how much ammunition I bought her for Christmas. So she had nearly 1,000 rounds of ammunition. And she was stuck up in the house. So he actually gave a lot of very vital information to the police and it really helped them on how to proceed. Eventually, the mother did arrive as well, but she did take a little bit longer to get to the scene.
Now, meanwhile, there's a SWAT team being organized. And what happens of this endeavor?
Well, SWAT back in 1979 is not as slick as we think it probably was. These guys were all full-time police officers. Some were off duty that day. They were called to the scene. And when they arrive, they show up in their cars and start to unpack their gear from the boots of their car. SWAT didn't have a huge van with these guys in camouflage who come jumping out with their huge weaponry like we see today. It was a very, without using the word low budget, it was just sort of low tech is probably the best way to say it. Police officers didn't wear bulletproof vests. They had kind of a white bib that kind of sat just above their navel and just below their shoulders, which kind of covered the middle of their chest, but really not much of a bulletproof vest at all. And so they were putting these on and trying to get themselves in some kind of position. Luckily, San Diego being a huge military town, a lot of these guys on the SWAT team were ex-Marines, ex-Army, and very skilled with weaponry. They took positions on houses around the backside of the house, around the top of the school. Some were just down at the end of the block, all positioned aiming at the front doors or the windows of the house. At this stage, SWAT only knew what Ted Kasenak and the other police officers on the scene could tell them. And that was, we have a shooter in the house. They had no idea how many shooters. They really only had the idea from the father of how, what kind of weaponry they were talking about. And slowly, as time ticked on, no more shooting, no more bullets rang out. Once Brenda got off the phone with the reporters for the final time, she didn't fire another shot. So they weren't really sure what they had at this point. What else was in that house? Perhaps the perpetrator had killed themselves. They really didn't know. And SWAT really had to move close to the house, really small baby steps, to find out what was going on at the premises. I was lucky enough to find the original dispatch tapes from the police. Now, these are not digital. These are not things that were kept on file back in 1979. I went into a group of radio enthusiasts, and one of them was a 12-year-old who had a love for police dispatch. And he just recorded this on a cassette tape, and I managed to find him, and he shared it with me. It's the most remarkable of finds. It's incredible insight into what the San Diego PD did at a time where they had no idea of the hostility that was taking place or what the perpetrator had in mind or even the threat. It's quite remarkable. And I tried to capture them as best I could in the first 10 chapters of the book to show what people do when they're forced to do it. And I think it's remarkable. The San Diego PD are true heroes.
You talk about the San Diego Police Department and Detective Olson at 12:06 now. Brenda Spencer answers the phone. And so they have a conversation. What any kind of value does she convey to Detective Olson?
Yeah, and that's some doing. By 12 o'clock, I mean, we're talking almost, you know, it's 3.5 hours after the shooting and almost 3 hours since her final bullet. They were calling the house and calling the house, and she wasn't answering. They shut off the power. She's unaware. Ted Olson is in the sort of the bathroom of the house next door, kind of yelling through the window, answer the phone. Chet Thurston, who's the other interrogator. Both these guys are highly skilled military interrogators. These guys have been, you know, they've been around the block. These were not young interrogators. They're very seasoned veterans in the SDPD. He was out of the front with the bullhorn. She's trying to make noise to get her attention, you know, staying in a safe position, obviously. Eventually, she answers the phone, and Olson starts chatting to her, saying, hey, you know, how can I help? Trying to build that rapport. She ends up telling him all kinds of things about how proud she was of what she did. You know, there was nothing like seeing feathers fly. And she was quite bullshit and arrogant, a lot of bravado, she said. And I think she was semi-impressed with the fact that she might be on television. She was impressed that somebody was listening to her. And then in the next sentence, she's saying, like, you know, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble with my father. So it was clearly, it was an odd conversation, to say the least. And I think Olson had to dig deep and use all of his skill. And the negotiations went on for hours. It was a 3-hour negotiation by telephone.
Meanwhile, they interview her father, Wally, and the mother, and to try to get some information from them that will help in this negotiation. Tell us what the fruits of that negotiation are eventually and the terms.
Well, I think I'll start with the terms. I think the terms were, you come out and bring your weapons and everything will end up okay and your parents will forgive you and everything will be okay. And I think Brenda really believed that. He kept saying, are you hungry? And she said, well, yeah, I could really do with a hamburger. And they promised her a Whopper. And, you know, it seems quite a remarkable thing. Brenda, of course, now disputes that. I've written to Brenda and asked her a number of bits of information. She disputes that she wanted a Whopper. She really likes fried chicken and said she had some in the house. Yeah. Was eating it during that time. But, you know, again, it's in Paul Olson's notes. And I don't debate what he wrote. She probably did just agree to anything at that stage. I think she was probably quite scared. I'm not so sure what the mother offered at all in this. There's nothing with the police files. She was unavailable for comment. I was unable to find any connection that she made with Brenda directly during this time. But Wally certainly had said, you know, he explained that she was a truant from her school and she had gone to a different school and she didn't have a lot of friends and she was a bit of a tomboy. And he was sort of giving a lot of background information about Brenda. But sadly, neither of them played any huge role in her coming out and surrendering that day. I think that was just pure great police work from the interrogators. But also Brenda was recognizing that, you know, the time is ticking. There's no electricity on in the house. I'm kind of here alone. I think maybe she, by her mind, was sobering up. She claims that she was under the influence. I think it just was time to get out of the house. I know Olson and Thurston were desperate to get her out by 3 o'clock because kids were coming home from school. You're going to hit rush hour. There's a number of things, the number of threats that could reemerge if she weren't out of that house and apprehended. He did say to her, can you bring out the ammunition and your weapons? And remarkably, and this is something I haven't seen very often, she exits the house with two weapons. One was the .22 she got for Christmas. The other was a pellet gun, which wasn't going to hurt anybody. But she carried them both with so much care. She cared for both of her weapons. I think it's interesting, her intent using the pellet gun does make a lot of people believe that her intent to kill was diminished because she had this pellet gun that wasn't going to kill anyone. I don't know if you're in that camp, but some people think that. And then he says to her, can you go in and get the ammunition now? And so Brenda gets back up off the sidewalk from in front of the house,
wow,
walks back into the house and gets the ammunition. And I asked Paul directly this. I said, why did you have her go back and get the ammunition when you had her with the weapon? She was no threat to anyone. You had her. And he said, well, she said she wanted to do it. And I trusted her. And she did go and do it and got the ammunition. And I'm glad she did. And he left it at that. So Paul obviously was in control of the situation as a negotiator. And Brenda did exactly as he said. So I'm in no position to tell a seasoned negotiator like Paul Olson what was the right thing to do. But I've never seen it since.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 97% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. Ritual invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin. Essential for Women 18 Plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. Ritual just released Symbiotic Plus, a gut health supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic all in one minty capsule. My wife Lisa and I were initially impressed with Ritual's successful clinical trials and decided to try Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus. And when Ritual for Men 50 Plus became available, I began to take Ritual every day. It's been over 3 years for me and longer for my wife Lisa. We both continue to feel a significant difference every day. Now we're both taking Symbiotic Plus, as we know gut health is so important. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, we talked about this incredible historic arrest, or her surrender and arrest. There is the issue immediately in 1979 with California legal guidelines, you say, if a crime was a result of adult thinking, a minor could be charged and tried as an adult. Tell us about that.
Well, it's far more clear cut today than it was in 1979. California politics was a strange thing at that time, but also jurisdictions and who was in charge of what and the whole legality of what was happening in California was a crazy time. For those who remember the 70s, I mean, I was just a child, but you know, you had such things going on with Patty Hearst and Stockholm Syndrome, and you had Twinkie defenses. You had a number of different crazy sort of legal aspects that were playing up, especially with insanity. Now, it was decided quite quickly that Brenda was going to be tried as an adult. And it was kind of just happening around Brenda. She had a court-appointed attorney who was trying to help her as best he could. And he was trying to get the information out and say, hey, this is a young, vulnerable girl who didn't know what she was doing. Toxicology reports came up that she was clean. She wasn't an influence of anything. She was quickly decided that it was just pure evil and she was going to be tried as an adult. And I think from that moment forward, it was just about damage limitation. Let's try and find a way to give Brenda the least sentences possible. She eventually pleaded guilty. It is a long, dirty, dusty road for her to get to that place. She truly believed, from the letters that she had written to family and to friends, she truly believed that she was going to get out of jail not too long at all. I don't think she understood what she had done or that even killing somebody was going to put her in jail for the rest of her life. She eventually plea bargained to 25 to life, but under a lot of really strange home environment circumstances and things that were happening where I don't think she used her best judgment. If she had just accepted the guilty plea and got life in prison, she could very well be out of jail now. But by taking 25 to life meant that she would serve at least 25 years before her parole hearings even begin. So Brenda is now in prison, I think, my personal opinion, because of a misjudgment during the plea bargaining phase of pleading guilty. It's all outlined in the book, and I try and cover it. It is a really, you know, Dan, you've read the book. It's a lengthy piece of California litigation that's difficult to read. And even writing it, I had to go through it a number of times to make sure that I cover this. Because it's not as easy as just saying, she's tried as an adult, and she plea bargained 25 to life. It's actually far more murkier than that.
Absolutely. You also say there's contributing factors, major ones, like the media frenzy. And her attorney, court-appointed attorney, tried to address that and won't get into the whole legal battle, but there was, trying to fight for a change of venue and things like that. In this book, you wanted to dispel the mythology and the misinformation that had sprang up almost immediately via the media. And also, you talk about the damage that Brenda Spencer did to her own case. Enduring damage to her case by some of the statements she did make, but also some of the misinformation that was reported by the media that was, again, in a frenzy to get any and new information regarding the case.
Yeah, in the book, I cover a number of different things. I tackle her best friend at the time. I try and cover the family as close as I can to just sort of show you what type of, actually a quite typical family. I mean, they were divorced, but it was quite typical in that respect. They're originally from Arkansas and were gun owners. I don't think there's anything unusual about that in America, actually. And I don't think there's anything unusual about a 16-year-old having a 22 rifle. In fact, many do. I know here over in the UK where I live now, it's quite a remarkable thing. And certainly to Bob Geldof, who wrote the famous song, I Don't Like Mondays, taking her quote and making money out of it. He must have found that was a remarkable thing for a 16-year-old girl to have a gun. It just isn't in the United States. And his words in the song and what was happening with that at the same time, they release it specifically at the time of the trial. They then release the album at the same time as the guilty plea. You know, every time it hits the news, there's also a second story about the release of this song. So they were following the trial quite nicely to capture some sales, as they call it, cash from chaos. But it's really the family and the father in particular that actually causes her so much trouble and grief during this plea bargaining phase. I was unable to speak to her attorney, Michael McGlynn. He had retired by the time I was writing the book. I did reach out to him and he said, look, any information you need. I have now learned that he was very ill at the time and has since passed away, and may he rest in peace. He was a decent man. I was unable to get any new information out of him, but it was really well documented through the years of how Michael McGlynn was battling not just Brenda, but the fact that she was so stoic, but also the father who was up to some stuff. And I don't know if you want to get into this now, but for me, it is very key how Brenda behaved at the time of the incident, and certainly at the time leading into her imprisonment.
Yes, let's discuss that, because her father is a fascinating and an important part of this story.
Yeah, and I'm going to be brutally honest with you, Danny. He's a bit of a scumbag.
Yes.
Not my favorite guy. Let's just tell the story. So Wally is this guy who's kind of a loner, really tight with his money. He had a pretty good job. He had some good cash. He owned his house, which had a very low mortgage, and he had some investment property down in the South County. It's believed that Brenda's family was poor and there was alcohol over the house. Just not true. None of the police photos show any alcohol. There's no alcohol in your system. Wally was known to be a bit of a teetotaler. He didn't drink at all. He had plenty of money. He was just stingy and he was messy and the house was a mess. And, you know, Brenda often went to school with unwashed hair and had knots in her hair and was a tomboy. And, you know, she was very close with her father in that respect. So she goes to jail. She's in juvenile hall, or juvie, as they call it in San Diego. And another girl comes to juvenile hall who burned her house down. Her name was Sheila McCoy. Now, Brenda says that Sheila McCoy really liked her, and that Sheila McCoy wanted to be like Brenda because Brenda was this face of evil. She had become this sort of very famous criminal in San Diego very quickly, as you can imagine. Well, the father took a shine to Sheila McCoy. And when she was moved from a closed facility at juvenile hall across the road to an open facility, he helped her abscond from that facility and she moved in with him. So Wally, while his daughter is on trial for murder, shacks up with a 17-year-old arsonist and knocks her up, and then has a child with her while Brenda is awaiting her plea bargain. So while Brenda is deciding what to do with the rest of her life, whether it's in jail or out of jail or what decision she's going to make, her father is saying, don't have an evasive trial. Plead guilty, because I don't want the lawyers and the cops and everybody digging into our personal lives, because you're going to find out that I'm a pedophile, that I like little girls. And it's quite a disgusting moment in their family history, is the fact that Brenda now is, if she wants to do the right thing by her father, that's not saying anything. But actually, at that moment, with a little bit of clarity and maybe a little bit of guidance, Brenda should have said, hey, something's wrong at home. And my dad's a bad guy. And maybe things would have turned out different for her. That story moves on. And Wally ends up having the baby with Sheena McCoy. She ends up disappearing out of the scene. She's remarried and done a number of good things with her life. Nothing of any note. They have a daughter named Bree, who's named after a local newscaster, Bree Walker, in the area. Bree and Brenda never get along. They've never really even met. And she's skated off into the distance with Wally's money. He's passed away and she's living out of state. And Brenda sort of has no family structure at all. It's quite a sad scenario for the Spencer family all the way around. The only person in her life is her mother, who's elderly and still lives in the same house around the corner. It's quite a tragic event. But that being said, I think if your child were a murderer, you'd have to make those decisions as to how you deal with that. Wally, on the other hand, saw it as an opportunity and thought, yeah, I'm going to shoot up to juvenile hall and prey on some of the young girls that are imprisoned there. Quite a remarkable thing.
With these damaging statements that she made to reporters and to Detective Olson, things saying like she was happy that she killed a pig when she shot a police officer. Parole hearings, you describe all these parole hearings and various parole hearings when she was denied and she had to wait a minimum of 3 years, 4 years, even 5 years. Tell us about the fight for parole and what she eventually does say at one of these parole hearings, what the narrative becomes.
Well, you know, and these included the book because it's interesting. You know, initially, you know, she called in the reporters at her first parole hearing to say that I'm not a cold-blooded killer. It wasn't me. You know, it could have been somebody else. She made a statement saying it wasn't me at all. And that seems quite remarkable considering, you know, she spoke to the reporters, you know, in real time and told them what she was up to and what she wanted to do next. She was banged to rights. I don't think the investigators, you know, needed much work here. They just transcribed what she had already told the interrogators and the newspaper reporters. I'm not really sure where she felt that this was the best defense to get her out of prison was to just plead, it wasn't me. But then over the course of time, I think she becomes a bit more savvy with the system in prison. She eventually says that, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. And it was because my father had been doing horrible things to me since I was a little girl and was beating me up and doing all these horrible things. Of course, Wally didn't attend the parole hearing, so he had no idea this was going on or that she was saying horrible things about him. And of course, the information about Wally marrying this 17-year-old, well, 16 at the time they started dating, but 17 at the time they marry, it's almost as if because the things about Brenda from the song, from the alcohol in the house, from the fact that she was just this face of evil and everyone believed that she was the face of evil. And I think they're right in saying that. She was the face of evil. I think they turned a blind eye to things that were happening at the house. They just weren't having it. And I think because Brenda waited, you know, nearly 14 years before actually putting some meat on the bones of these accusations, I was able to go through the records and go deep into the police files to find something from someone who had possibly mentioned that there was some sexual abuse or some deviancy from the father with Brenda. I was unable to find anything other than one psychologist who said that Wally enjoyed Brenda combing his hair and sitting on his lap and those sort of things. It's nothing that leads towards definitive answer about there being some sort of abuse, but it certainly does raise the question that nobody delved deeper into that question. I don't know how it would have got her off the original trial. Certainly hasn't gotten her out on parole. And the story does change slightly. It becomes a little more developed. The parole panel asked her deeper questions. There's nothing at all legally to back it up other than Brenda's word. But
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Life doesn't have a pause button. That's why Capella University's FlexPath learning format lets you set your own deadlines and adjust them if something comes up. Imagine how a flexible education can make a difference for you at capella.edu.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Tend to believe her. I'm not in a position to say she's not telling the truth. I think my question for Brenda, and I've never really had an opportunity to ask it with any tact, is why did you wait so long to tell the truth if it is the truth? It does appear that Brenda is just changing her tact to find the way that she can get out of prison. It doesn't appear to be honest if you read all of the parole hearing transcripts one after another. And that's why I put them in the book that way. So you can read the trail of events that she's taken to try and find her niche to get out of prison. Some honesty from Brenda wouldn't go a long way. And I think it would also help a lot to maybe put some more information towards the phenomenon of school shootings that's happening in America. She's never, ever said why she did it. She's shown remorse. She said she was sorry. She even said she feels accountable for all school shootings because of what she did. But she doesn't actually give that clarity as to the mindset of why I go from being an unhappy teenager to picking up a weapon and shooting children. There's a big gap for me in that, and I try to uncover it as best I can.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for this commercial break.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You talk about corresponding with Brenda Spencer and any insights that you gain from that correspondence. And you do write that you tried to look for her reasons for the shooting and any kind of proof of abuse and other claims that she said that she was an addict since she was 11 years old and had done PCP. Again, there was no evidence that she could put forth or you could find to support that.
I think it's hard to go back to the 1970s and find evidence of a teenager doing drugs. In California in the 1970s, loads of teenagers were doing drugs. The curious thing is that she was tested for all drugs and alcohol at the time, and the toxicology reports came back negative. The only drug that she was not tested for, because there wasn't testing available in 1979, was PCP. And this just happens to be the only drug that she says that she was on at the time. So the convenience level was quite high for her. And again, this is years later. So she claims she was on PCP and did the shooting, and it just happens to be the only drug they could test for. I think that's that core part of the parole hearing that's so curious, is it's just very convenient at this stage.
You chronicle the influence that Brenda Spencer had and the continued phenomena of school shootings. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I call it the first modern school shooting. There were school shootings before Brenda. There's the famous Whitman shooting in Texas, which is considered a school shooting, but of course, very different. I think the reason why I say Brenda is the first modern school shooter is just because the legacy that's left after the fact. She did attend the school that she shot at, although she didn't attend school at the time. It's more of a convenience shooting for her than taking a weapon and going after a target, which seems to be, to say that, the way a lot of school shootings are happening now. I think the song, I think her image, who she was, the sheer disregard for authority, I think she became, up until the Columbine, I think she became the face of school shooting. And I think since Columbine, we now find that they can be premeditated and you know, planned over the long term. Whereas Brenda, there is an argument that it was planned beforehand, but I really don't think so. I think she had the idea that I was going to do it. She went out and did it, but not as planned as say, Columbine. But I do feel that all other school shootings sort of got a little bit of a kickstart from Brenda. And the fact that she's still alive and in prison and still kind of, in a weird regard, like the Manson sisters, she's held in some sort of, there is some hero worship with her within a certain culture of America. And I find that pretty disturbing. And I know that I'm probably contributing to it with my book. I'm not going to lie. You and I both are in a business of death and murder.
Sure.
But I truly hope that in writing the book, I'm listing the facts as they happen, as factually as I can, so that we can learn from it. And it is sad that in doing that, I may have accidentally glorified Brenda myself, when actually my intent was to learn from her. And that's probably my only regret from writing the book. But she corresponded with me for years. We're still corresponding today. She's read the book. She's quite a funny character. She's still 17 in her mind. She's a real good example of arrested development. She's never really turned into an adult. She's never had any of the challenges adults would have. Certainly, she's in prison. She hasn't been the most popular prisoners, and she hasn't been the most perfect of prisoners either. But now she's 60 years old. She's obese. She has no teeth. Her hearing is poor. Her eyesight is poor. She's now just sitting in California Institute for Women in the middle of the desert. I'm just trying to get through the days, and perhaps that's where she should be. I don't know. I'm not going to pass judgment on that, but I wish her well in her attempt to get out.
You write that she had a hearing, or was to have a hearing, in August 2022. What of that?
Well, yeah, there were a few reporters, and I was one of the lucky people to be selected to go to that hearing. And at the last minute, like the day before, actually, it was really quite soon before the hearing, we were notified that only one person of the media was going to attend and transcribe the entire event. Brenda rocked up, and she did what's called a three-year stip. So a number of years ago, she's got a new attorney who has got this new plan for her to get out. And because she was a teenager, they're going to, you know, look at the new laws. And laws are changing all the time in California. It's a moving target. I think they decided that they were going to put a plan together where she was going to tick all these boxes that the parole board wanted. And I think they realized that getting close to her parole board hearing, that she hadn't done all these things. And she went into them to say, hey, look, I've still got a few things to finish off that you've asked me to do. Can I get what's called a three-year stipulation, which means that we're going to forego this parole hearing to give me more time to complete all the things you had asked for, my action plan, if you will. And the parole board accepted that and gave her, what, again, the three-year stip. Now, three-year stip really means 18 months.
Okay.
So actually, you know, a year from now, she might very well be having another parole hearing. And this just kind of happens. And the reason why that's important is because throughout her prisoner, her incarceration career, we'll call it, there have been victims who have been attending, one of which is Cam Miller, who was actually shot by Brenda, and he's now a probation officer. And he's attended every single probation hearing for Brenda. And in the state of California, I've looked at the records. I can't find a person who was paroled where the victim attended the parole hearing. And I think he's making it his life mission. He certainly works within law enforcement. I think he's making it his life mission to make sure he attends every one of these. He's in a position to get the information. And I think he'll be attending again in a year's time. And I think Brenda's chances of getting out are quite slim because of that. And Cam Miller, I think, you know, he's got a really good case to keep Brenda in. He was actually shot by her himself. And I think that's really vivid testimony whenever he speaks to these parole hearings. It's all captured within the book. I try and capture what Cam Miller says and his emotions. He's a very, very intelligent man. And I don't think he's going to let Brenda get it out anytime soon.
You write about the memorial that was at the school, and then the school was torn down and another school built. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, San Diego is a growing city and it's forever changing. I think actually at the time that at Cleveland Elementary, the school she shot from across the road from her house, the attendance was about 155 students, but they were building other schools around the area, bigger, more modern schools. I think it was probably destined to close in the next 10 years anyway, but certainly a shooting at that school does put the writing on the wall. It reopened the following week after the shooting, and it was important to get the students back in to give some closure. A remarkable job from people who work in education in San Diego to get that school up and running. I do know that the psychologists in San Diego were then called upon to different school shootings around the country, certainly all the way into the 80s. I'm currently working on a book about schools in Wyoming, and all of these psychologists were called up there in 1986 to assist as well. I think San Diego Police Force, I think Brenda, I think the psychology, the education, everything that surrounds this case has really kind of been the first template for school shootings. And I think going into, you know, 2021 and 2022, when I was finishing the book and Uvalde happened at Robb Elementary School, to watch that on television, how different the police behaved that day compared to how the police behaved in January 1979. It was staggering. And it left me with an awful lot of sadness to think that 43 years later, we're not any better at stopping school shootings. And I think the book for me becomes more poignant now because Brenda was just a young girl with a gun who had a half-hearted plan. These kids today are coming with much larger weapons, with a much larger plan, and the death tolls are getting larger, and the police force are running away. It's harsh, but that's what happened in Uvalde. And I'm really sad to hear it. And I hope that maybe Ted Kaczynak, the hero in San Diego, could make a phone call to Texas and to other jurisdictions and say, hey, guys, here's what I did, and you can be a hero too. The Uvalde thing really upset me when I was finishing my book and putting it to the publisher.
So you say that seems that no one, not society, not these police departments, have learned enough or adequately enough to prevent any kind of shooting in the future.
Well, all I can say is that history is proving that to be true. You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm just a guy who wrote a book about a school shooter, and I'm a crime historian, and I've followed the trails. School shootings are still happening. And if we were to find out that there was another school shooting tomorrow, we wouldn't be surprised. We've had a number of active shooters in many different parts of society all over the United States. We've had a number in the last few weeks. In fact, it just doesn't surprise us anymore that there's an active shooter. And I really think that we need to start looking, not just making categories of types of crimes, but actually look deeper into why they're choosing that form of outlet for the crime. And Brenda, I think may hold some of the key to that. I don't know if she realizes it, but certainly she's one of the few that survived this type of attack. And I'm not saying it's a Hannibal Lecter thing where she's going to help us find other shooters. I'm not saying that. But there certainly is some education that we could get from Brenda. And nobody has gone to speak to her. She's spoken to no one in 40 years. I was the first person to approach her about writing a book. I was the first one to approach her about her relationship with her father. I found that really shocking that here we have a real life school shooter who might be able to give us some insight as to her thinking. And no one's tried to broach the subject. Instead, we want to lock her away, put her in prison, pretend it never happened, just make her the face of evil while everyone around her is making money off of her image. I think there's something a bit diabolical about that. I'm being honest with you, Dan.
Absolutely. I have to agree. After reading your book and the story of I Don't Like Mondays, the song, and the fame and success that Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats had for themselves via this song just didn't come true. And all the negativity that was associated with it really prevented this song from the kind of success that the record company and the Boomtown Rats thought it might.
Well, you say that, but in actual fact, you know, over here in the UK, it was a huge number one for a number of weeks.
It
springboarded Bob Geldof to the position to create something like Live Aid and you know, his help for Africa. You know, in the book, I do two chapters on Bob Geldof to explain who he is and how his life is actually just as tragic as some of the victims from the school shooting. You know, Bob's had a real tough time of it as well. And you know, I wish him luck. But him making that song about Brenda was a pure attempt to make money and to corner the American market, and it backfired horrifically for him. I don't feel that bad for Bob in that respect. Brenda's prison life is probably very different from Bob's, but yet they both have fame for the same event.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, and Lee Hunt, for coming on and talking about your book, I Don't Like Mondays, the true story behind America's first modern school shooting. I know this is a Wild Blue Press release, and it's available on Amazon. Tell us about that.
Wild Blue Press is a great option for first-time authors. They're specifically mostly about true crime, but they do other different genres. It's a great publisher. Check it out at wildbluepress.com, and you can go on Amazon, Enley Hunt, I Don't Like Mondays. It's about the first modern school shooter, Brenda Spencer. And that's the best way to just pick up the book, give it a read, let me know what you think. Always available online. You should be able to find me.
Thank you so much. And Lee Hunt, I Don't Like Mondays, the true story behind America's first modern school shooting. Thank you so much for this interview. And
hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Good night.